Have you ever wondered why the Jewish people are so resilient? How has such an ancient nation survived centuries of persecution, exile, and adversity? The answer is rooted in an epic story that defies time and common logic. Defying all expectations, a people born in the desert became a light to the nations. But what if I told you that it all began with an apparently impossible promise made to a man without children? A promise that would change the course of history forever. You're about to discover the fascinating saga of the 12 tribes of Israel. A story of unwavering faith, shocking betrayals, and miraculous redemptions that will make you question everything you thought you knew about determination and purpose. Get ready for a revelation that could transform your perspective on life and destiny. It all begins with a man named Abram, later known as Abraham. The words of the Lord echoed through the ages, as recorded in Genesis 12, 1, 2. Leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. Imagine the scene. A 75-year-old man, without children, receives a promise of becoming the father of a great nation. It seems crazy, doesn't it? But Abraham believed. He left everything behind and set out into the unknown, guided only by his faith. Years passed, and the promise seemed further away. Abraham and his wife Sarah were growing old, and still they had no children. But God is faithful to his promises, even when they seem impossible in human eyes. The book of Genesis tells us, in chapter 21, verses 1 and 2, "Now the Lord was gracious to Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did for Sarah what he had promised. Sarah became pregnant and bore a son to Abraham in his old age, at the very time God had promised him." The birth of Isaac was just the beginning. God renewed his promise, declaring in Genesis 22:17, "I will surely bless you and make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as the sand on the seashore." Isaac grew up and married Rebekah. They had twins, Esau and Jacob. And here, friends, is where the story becomes really interesting. Jacob, the younger one, received the blessing meant for the firstborn through a scheme. This generated a rivalry that forced him to flee. During his flight, Jacob had a supernatural encounter with God. The Lord's words, recorded in Genesis 28:13, resonated in Jacob's heart. "I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham, and the God of Isaac. I will give you and your descendants the land on which you are lying." Jacob worked for his uncle Laban for 20 years, married Leah and Rachel, and had 12 sons by 4 different women. These 12 sons would become the patriarchs of the 12 tribes of Israel. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, Asher, Issachar, Zebulun, Joseph, and Benjamin. Each name carries a deep meaning, reflecting the circumstances of their birth and the characteristics that would define their tribes. Reuben, the firstborn, whose name means "see a son," lost his birthright due to a transgression. Simeon and Levi, known for their impetuous anger, received a mixed blessing from their father. Judah, whose name means praise, received the promise of the royal lineage. The sons of the maidservants, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher, though born under less favorable circumstances, also became leaders of important tribes. Issachar and Zebulun, sons of Leah, represented hard work and maritime prosperity, respectively. Joseph, Jacob's favorite son, born of his beloved Rachel, would play a crucial role in the family's survival. And Benjamin, the youngest, born in great pain, would become a fierce and courageous tribe. Each of these sons carried within them the potential of a nation. Their personalities, strengths, and weaknesses shaped the character of the tribes that would bear their names. The promise made to Abraham was being fulfilled before everyone's eyes. But the path to becoming a great nation was far from smooth. Jealousy, rivalries, and challenges were just beginning. The journey of the 12 tribes of Israel would be marked by trials, miracles, and an unwavering faith in the God of their fathers. The story was just beginning. The seeds of a nation were planted, but the soil would be watered with tears, sweat, and sometimes blood. The covenant made with Abraham was alive in each of these 12 men, a promise that would transcend generations and change the course of human history. The story of the 12 tribes of Israel takes an unexpected turn with Joseph, the 11th son of Jacob. Born to Rachel, the beloved wife, Joseph quickly became his father's favorite. Genesis 37:3 tells us, Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons, because he had been born to him in his old age, and he made a richly ornamented robe for him. This favoritism sparked jealousy among his brothers, planting the seeds of a family drama that would change the fate of an entire nation. As a young man, Joseph had prophetic dreams that only intensified his brother's resentment. In Genesis 37:5-7, we read, "Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him all the more. He said to them, 'Listen to this dream I had. We were binding sheaves of grain out in the field when suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright, while your sheaves gathered around mine and bowed down to it.'" The interpretation was clear. Joseph would rule over his brothers. This was too much for them to bear. Jealousy turned to hatred, and hatred into a terrible plan. When the opportunity arose, the brothers acted. Genesis 37:24-28 recount, "They took him and threw him into a cistern empty. There was no water in it. When the Midianite merchants came by, his brothers pulled Joseph up out of the cistern and sold him for 20 shekels of silver to the Ishmaelites, who took him to Egypt." Thus began Joseph's journey to Egypt, a foreign land where he would face unimaginable challenges. Sold into slavery, he arrived at the house of Potiphar, an official of Pharaoh. Despite the adverse circumstances, Joseph prospered. Genesis 39:2-3 states, "The Lord was with Joseph, so that he prospered, and he lived in the house of his Egyptian master. When his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord gave him success in everything he did." But Joseph's success attracted trouble. Potiphar's wife attempted to seduce him, and when he resisted, she falsely accused him. Joseph was thrown into prison, but even there God did not abandon him. Genesis 39:21 assures us, "The Lord was with him, he showed him kindness, and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warden." In prison, Joseph interpreted the dreams of two of Pharaoh's officials. When Pharaoh had disturbing dreams that no one could interpret, Joseph was called. With divine wisdom, he not only interpreted the dreams, but also offered a plan to save Egypt from impending famine. Impressed, Pharaoh declared in Genesis 41:39-40, "Since God has made all this known to you, there is no one so discerning and wise as you. You shall be in charge of my palace, and all my people are to submit to your orders. Only with respect to the throne will I be greater than you." Overnight, Joseph went from prisoner to governor of Egypt. His prediction came true: 7 years of abundance followed by 7 years of severe famine. Under Joseph's leadership, Egypt stored food during the good years, becoming the only country prepared for the crisis. The famine did not spare Canaan, where Jacob and his other sons still lived. Desperate for food, Joseph's brothers traveled to Egypt, unaware that they would bow before the one they had sold into slavery years earlier. Joseph recognized them, but they did not recognize him. After a series of tests to see if his brothers had changed, Joseph finally revealed his identity. In a touching moment, Joseph said to his brothers in Genesis 45:4-5, "Then Joseph said to his brothers, 'Come close to me.' When they had done so, he said, 'I am your brother Joseph, the one you sold into Egypt. And now, do not be distressed and do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you.'" This revelation led to an emotional reconciliation and the reunion of Jacob's entire family in Egypt. Genesis 46:26-27 tells us, "All those who went to Egypt with Jacob, those who were his direct descendants, not counting his sons' wives, numbered 66. With the two sons who had been born to Joseph in Egypt, the members of Jacob's family, which went to Egypt, were 70 in all. Thus, the 12 tribes of Israel found refuge in Egypt, escaping the famine and prospering under Joseph's protection. What began as a family tragedy transformed into salvation for the entire nation. God's promise to Abraham remained alive, and the stage was set for the next chapter in the epic story of Israel. The years of prosperity in Egypt did not last forever. Over time, the memory of Joseph and his contribution to saving Egypt faded away. A new pharaoh ascended to the throne, bringing an era of oppression for the descendants of Jacob. The book of Exodus tells us about this dramatic change. In Exodus 1:8-10, we read, "Then a new king who did not know about Joseph came to power in Egypt. 'Look,' he said to his people, 'the Israelites have become far too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous, and if war breaks out, will join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country. Fear led to oppression, and oppression led to slavery. The Egyptians imposed forced labor on the Israelites, hoping to weaken and control their growth. Exodus 1:11 describes, "So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor, and they built Pithom and Ramesses as store cities for Pharaoh." But the more the Egyptians oppressed them, the more the Israelites multiplied, fulfilling God's promise to Abraham. The Pharaoh's cruelty reached new heights when he ordered that all Israelite male babies be killed at birth. It was in this context of terror that a baby was born who would change the course of history. Exodus 2:1-2 tells us, "Now a man of the tribe of Levi married a Levite woman, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. When she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. This baby was Moses. His mother, unable to hide him any longer, made a desperate and courageous decision." Exodus 2:3-4 recounts. "But when she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. Then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him." What happened next was nothing short of providential. The Pharaoh's daughter found the baby and, moved by compassion, decided to adopt him. Through a clever arrangement, Moses' sister managed to have their own mother hired as a wet nurse. Thus, Moses grew up knowing his Hebrew heritage, but also educated as an Egyptian prince. Years passed, and Moses, now an adult, witnessed the oppression of his people. One day, seeing an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, Moses intervened with fatal consequences. Exodus 2:11-12 narrates, "One day, after Moses had grown up, he went out to where his own people were and watched them at their hard labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. Looking this way and that and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand." This act forced Moses to flee to Midian, where he lived as a shepherd for 40 years. It was there in the desert that God called him to an extraordinary mission. The call came in a spectacular way, through a burning bush that was not consumed. In Exodus 3:7-10, God declares, "The Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them up out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey. Now go. I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt." Moses, initially reluctant, accepted the call after God promised to be with him and perform miraculous signs. Accompanied by his brother Aaron, Moses returned to Egypt to confront the Pharaoh and demand the release of the Israelites. The confrontation that followed was epic. The Pharaoh, with a hardened heart, repeatedly refused to free the Israelites, even in the face of devastating plagues that God sent upon Egypt. Each plague demonstrated God's power over the Egyptian gods, culminating in the 10th and most terrible plague, the death of the firstborn. It was in this context that God instituted the Passover, a memorial of the liberation that was about to happen. In Exodus 12:12-13, God instructs, "On that same night I will pass through Egypt and strike down every firstborn, both people and animals, and I will bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt. I am the Lord. The blood will be a sign for you on the houses where you are, and when I see the blood, I will pass over you. No destructive plague will touch you when I strike Egypt." After this last and terrible plague, the Pharaoh finally relented. The Israelites, led by Moses, departed Egypt in a massive exodus. Exodus 12:37-38 gives us an idea of the magnitude of this event. The Israelites journeyed from Ramses to Succoth. There were about 600,000 men on foot, besides women and children. Many other people went up with them, as well as large droves of livestock, both flocks and herds. Thus, after 430 years of residence in Egypt, the 12 tribes of Israel, now a numerous nation, left the land of their slavery. Under Moses' leadership, they embarked on a journey that would take them through the desert towards the Promised Land. The promise made to Abraham was being fulfilled in extraordinary ways, and the stage was set for the next chapter in the epic story of Israel. The liberation of the Israelites from Egypt was just the beginning of an epic journey. Led by Moses, the 12 tribes of Israel faced an apparently impossible challenge, crossing the Red Sea. With Pharaoh's army in pursuit, the people cried out to God. The answer came in a miraculous way, as described in Exodus 14:21, 22. Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord drove the sea back by a strong east wind all night, and made the sea dry land, and the waters were divided. And the Israelites went into the midst of the sea on dry ground, with a wall of water on their right and a wall of water on their left. This event marked the definitive birth of Israel as a free nation. After crossing, Moses and the people sang a song of praise, celebrating God's victory over the Egyptians. Exodus 15, 1. 2 records the beginning of this hymn. Then Moses and the Israelites sang this song to the Lord. I will sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider he has thrown into the sea. The Lord is my strength and my song. He has become my salvation. This is my God, and I will praise him, my father's God, and I will exalt him. The journey through the desert, however, soon proved to be challenging. 3 days after crossing the Red Sea, the people found themselves without drinking water. At Marah, they encountered bitter water, causing the people to grumble against Moses. God, in his mercy, showed Moses how to make the water sweet, establishing a pattern of miraculous provision that would be repeated throughout the journey. The organization of the tribes during the journey in the desert was meticulous. Numbers 2 describes the arrangement of the camp. The Israelites shall camp each by his own standard, with the banners of their fathers' houses. They shall camp facing the tent of meeting at a distance. This formation was not only practical, but also symbolic, reflecting the order and structure that God desired for his people. Each tribe had its specific position. To the east, led by Judah, were Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. To the south, led by Reuben, were Reuben, Simeon, and Gad. To the west, led by Ephraim, were Ephraim, Manasseh, and Benjamin. To the north, led by Dan, were Dan, Asher, and Naphtali. The tribe of Levi, designated for priestly service, camped around the tabernacle at the center of the camp. During the journey, each tribe marched under its own banner, as described in Numbers 2:34. And the Israelites did according to all that the Lord commanded Moses. So they camped by their standards, and so they journeyed, each one according to his family and according to the house of his fathers. God's provision for his people in the desert was constant and miraculous. When the people complained of hunger, God provided manna and quail. Exodus 16:31 describes the manna. The people of Israel called the name of it manna. It was like coriander seed, white, and the taste of it was like wafers made with honey. This provision continued for 40 years until the people entered the Promised Land. Despite the divine provision, the journey in the desert was marked by challenges and rebellions. One of the most critical moments occurred when Moses sent 12 spies to explore Canaan. 10 of them returned with a discouraging report, leading the people to rebel against Moses and Aaron. Only Joshua and Caleb maintained faith in God's promise. As a result of this lack of faith, God decreed that that generation would wander in the desert for 40 years, as recorded in Numbers 14:33, 34. And your children shall be shepherds in the wilderness for 40 years, and shall suffer for your faithlessness until the last of your dead bodies lies in the wilderness. According to the number of the days in which you spied out the land, 40 days a year for each day, you shall bear your iniquity, and you shall know my displeasure. During those 40 years, each tribe faced its own challenges. The rebellion of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, against the leadership of Moses and Aaron, resulted in a severe divine judgment. The plague that followed was halted by Aaron's intercession, confirming his priestly role. The tribe of Levi, in particular, played a crucial role during the journey in the desert. In addition to their priestly responsibilities, they were tasked with dismantling, transporting, and reassembling the tabernacle each time the camp moved. Numbers 150:51 details this responsibility. And you shall appoint the Levites over the tabernacle of the testimony, and over all its furnishings, and over all that belongs to it. They shall carry the tabernacle and all its furnishings, and they shall take care of it. And they shall camp around the tabernacle. When the tabernacle is to set out, the Levites shall take it down, and when the tabernacle is to be pitched, the Levites shall set it up. And if any outsider comes near, he shall be put to death. Throughout the journey, God continued to shape Israel as a nation. At Mount Sinai, he gave the law to Moses, establishing the moral and religious foundations that would define Israel's identity. The 12 tribes learned to trust God for their daily needs and to live as a community under his law. As the 40 years came to an end, a new generation of Israelites prepared to enter the Promised Land. Knowing that he would not enter Canaan, Moses prepared the people with final speeches, reiterating the law and encouraging them to remain faithful to God. He also commissioned Joshua from the tribe of Ephraim as his successor. Thus, the 12 tribes of Israel, forged through the trials of the desert, were ready for the next chapter of their story, the conquest of the land that God had promised to their ancestors. 3 months after leaving Egypt, the 12 tribes of Israel arrived at the desert of Sinai. There, before the holy mountain, God would establish a unique covenant with his chosen people. In Exodus 19:3-6, we read God's words to Moses. So Moses went up the mountain to meet with God. And the Lord called to him from the mountain, saying, "Say this to the house of Jacob, and announce it to the Israelites. You have seen what I did to Egypt, and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now if you will obey me fully and keep my covenant, you will be my treasured possession among all nations. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." This covenant proposal marked a crucial moment in Israel's history. God was offering a special relationship, but it came with responsibilities. The people responded unanimously, as recorded in Exodus 19:8, and all the people responded together, "We will do everything the Lord has said." So Moses brought their answer back to the Lord. With the stage set, God manifested himself spectacularly on Mount Sinai. Exodus 19:16-18 describes the scene. "On the morning of the third day there was thunder and lightning, with a thick cloud over the mountain, and a very loud trumpet blast. Everyone in the camp trembled with fear. Then Moses led the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. Mount Sinai was covered with smoke, because the Lord had descended on it in fire. The smoke billowed up from it like smoke from a furnace, and the whole mountain trembled violently." It was in this imposing setting that God delivered the Ten Commandments, establishing the moral and ethical foundations for the nation of Israel. These commandments, recorded in Exodus 22:17, encompass both the people's relationship with God and with one another. In addition to the Ten Commandments, God provided a series of detailed laws and regulations covering aspects of religious, social, and economic life. These laws, collectively known as the Mosaic Law, would serve to shape Israel's unique identity as a holy nation. The tribe of Levi received a special role in this new order. In Numbers 3:5-7, God instructs Moses, "Bring the tribe of Levi and present them to Aaron the priest to assist him. They are to perform the duties for him and for the whole community at the tent of meeting by doing the work of the tabernacle. They are to be responsible for all the furnishings of the tent of meeting, and they are to perform the duties of the Israelites in connection with the tabernacle service. The construction of the tabernacle, the mobile sanctuary where God would dwell among his people, was a project that involved all the tribes." In Exodus 35:21, we see the generosity of the people, and everyone who was willing and whose heart moved them came and brought an offering to the Lord for the work on the tent of meeting, for all its service and for the sacred garments. Each tribe contributed according to their skills and resources. Bezalel from the tribe of Judah and Aholiab from the tribe of Dan were specially gifted to lead the artistic work. Exodus 35:30-35 details their skills and how God equipped them for this sacred task. The census of the tribes, recorded in the book of Numbers, not only counted the people but also organized Israel as a nation ready for the conquest of the Promised Land. Each tribe had its designated place, both in the camp and in the order of march. A crucial moment in solidifying the covenant was the ceremony described in Exodus 24:4-8. Moses then wrote down everything the Lord had said. He got up early the next morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain and set up 12 stone pillars representing the 12 tribes of Israel. Then he took the book of the covenant and read it to the people. They responded, "We will do everything the Lord has said. We will obey." Moses then took the blood, sprinkled it on the people, and said, "This is the blood of the covenant that the Lord has made with you, in accordance with all these words." This ceremony sealed the pact between God and the 12 tribes of Israel. They were now officially God's chosen people, with the responsibility to live according to his laws and be a light to the nations. However, Israel's faithfulness would be tested almost immediately. While Moses was on the mountain receiving additional instructions, the people grew impatient and built a golden calf to worship. This act of idolatry resulted in severe judgment, but also revealed God's mercy when Moses interceded for the people. Despite this setback, the covenant was renewed, the tabernacle was constructed, and the visible presence of God, in the form of a cloud by day and fire by night, began to guide the people on their journey. The 12 tribes of Israel, now united under God's law and organized as a nation, were ready to face the challenges ahead. The covenant made at Sinai would be the foundation of their national and spiritual identity for generations to come. With the generation that left Egypt having passed away in the desert, a new generation of Israelites was preparing to enter the promised land. Under the leadership of Joshua from the tribe of Ephraim, the 12 tribes of Israel positioned themselves at the banks of the Jordan River, ready to begin the conquest of Canaan. The crossing of the Jordan marked the beginning of this new phase. Similar to the crossing of the Red Sea, God performed a miracle as recorded in Joshua 3:15-16. As soon as the priests who carried the ark reached the Jordan and their feet touched the water's edge, the Jordan is at flood stage all during harvest. The water upstream stopped flowing. It piled up in a heap a great distance away, at a town called Adam in the vicinity of Zarethan, while the water flowing down to the Sea of the Arabah, that is the Dead Sea, was completely cut off. So the people crossed over opposite Jericho. The first city to be conquered was Jericho, whose miraculous fall is described in Joshua 6:20. When the trumpets sounded, the army shouted, and at the sound of the trumpets, the walls collapsed, so everyone charged in and they took the city. This victory established a pattern for subsequent conquests, demonstrating that Israel's success depended on its obedience to God. The campaign of conquest involved all the tribes, with each playing a crucial role. The tribe of Judah, destined for leadership, was often at the forefront of battles. In Joshua 15:13-14, we see an example of this tribe's courage. In accordance with the Lord's command, Joshua gave to Caleb, son of Jephunneh, a portion in Judah, Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron. Arba was the forefather of Anak. Caleb drove out from there the three Anakites, the descendants of Sheshai, Ahiman, and Talmai. The tribe of Ephraim and half the tribe of Manasseh, descendants of Joseph, received land in central Canaan. Joshua 16:4 states, "So the descendants of Joseph, Manasseh, and Ephraim received their inheritance." These tribes became powerful and influential, occupying some of the most fertile lands. The distribution of land among the tribes was a meticulous process, guided by God. In Joshua 18:10, we read, "In Shiloh, Joshua cast lots for them and assigned them the land, giving each Israelite their portion." Each tribe received a specific portion, reflecting not only its size but also the prophecies made by Jacob and Moses. The tribe of Simeon, for example, received its inheritance within the territory of Judah, fulfilling Jacob's prophecy about its dispersion. The tribe of Levi, designated for priestly service, did not receive a contiguous territory, but cities spread throughout the land. Joshua 21:41-42 summarizes, "The towns of the Levites in the territory held by the Israelites were 48, and they included their pasture lands. Each of these towns had pasture lands around it. This was true for all of them. Reuben, Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh chose to settle east of the Jordan in lands conquered during Moses' lifetime." Joshua 22:7-8 recounts their release to return to those lands. When Joshua sent them home, he blessed them, saying, "Return to your homes with your great wealth, with large herds of livestock, with silver, gold, bronze, and iron, and a great quantity of clothing. Divide the plunder from your enemies with your fellow Israelites." The conquest was neither complete nor instantaneous. Some areas remained under Canaanite control, as we see in Judges 1:27. but the tribe of Manasseh did not drive out the people of Beth Shan, or Taanach, or Dor, or Ibleam, or Megiddo, and their surrounding settlements, for the Canaanites were determined to stay in that region. Even so, by the end of Joshua's life, the major battles had been won, and the land was divided among the tribes. In his farewell address, Joshua reminded the people of God's faithfulness and urged them to remain faithful to the covenant. Joshua 23:14 records his words, "Now I am about to go the way of all the earth. You know with all your heart and soul that not one of all the good promises the Lord your God gave you has failed. Every promise has been fulfilled, not one has failed." The conquest of Canaan and the distribution of land among the tribes marked the fulfillment of the promise made by God to Abraham centuries earlier. Each tribe now had its own territory to develop, cultivate, and defend. This period set the stage for the next phase of Israel's history, where the tribes would face the challenge of living as a united nation under the covenant with God in a land surrounded by pagan peoples. With the death of Joshua, Israel entered a turbulent period known as the Era of the Judges. This time was marked by a recurring cycle of apostasy, oppression, repentance, and deliverance. The book of Judges 2:16-19 summarizes this pattern well. "Then the Lord raised up judges, who delivered them from the hands of those who plundered them. Yet they did not listen to their judges, but prostituted themselves, serving other gods and worshipping them. Unlike their ancestors, they quickly turned away from the way of their fathers, who had obeyed the commandments of the Lord. Whenever the Lord raised up a judge for them, he was with the judge, and saved them from the hands of their enemies, as long as the judge lived. For the Lord was moved to pity by their groaning, because of those who oppressed and afflicted them. But when the judge died, the people returned to even worse ways than their ancestors, serving other gods, worshipping them, and bowing down to them. They refused to abandon their practices and their stubborn ways." During this period, various tribes produced judges who led Israel in times of crisis. Othniel, from the tribe of Judah, was the first judge. Judges 3:9-10 states, "But when they cried out to the Lord, he raised up a deliverer for them, Othniel, son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, who delivered them. The Spirit of the Lord came upon him, so that he became Israel's judge and went to war. The Lord gave Cushan-Rishathaim, king of Aram, into his hands, and Othniel defeated him." Deborah, a prophetess from the tribe of Ephraim, judged Israel at a critical moment. Her leadership inspired Barak from the tribe of Naphtali to lead an army against Sisera. Judges 4:14-15 describes the victory. "Then Deborah said to Barak, 'Go, this is the day the Lord has given Sisera into your hands. Is not the Lord going ahead of you?' So Barak went down Mount Tabor, followed by 10,000 men. At Barak's advance, the Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and army by the sword, and Sisera abandoned his chariot and fled on foot. Gideon from the tribe of Manasseh led Israel against the Midianites with a reduced army, demonstrating that victory comes from the Lord, not from human strength. Judges 7:20-21 narrates the decisive moment. The three companies blew the trumpets and smashed the jars. Grasping the torches in their left hands and holding in their right hands the trumpets they were to blow, they shouted, 'A sword for the Lord and for Gideon!' Each one stood in his place around the camp, and all the Midianites ran, crying out as they fled. Jephthah, a warrior from Gilead, led Israel against the Ammonites. His story is marked by a tragic vow, but his leadership brought peace to Israel for a time. Judges 11:32-33 records his victory. Then Jephthah crossed over to the Ammonites to fight them, and the Lord gave them into his hands. He devastated 20 towns from Aroer to the vicinity of Minnith, as far as Abel-Keramim. Thus Israel subdued Ammon. Samson, from the tribe of Dan, was perhaps the most well-known judge. His supernatural strength was used to confront the Philistines, although his story is marked by personal weaknesses. Judges 15:14-15 describes one of his feats. When he arrived at Lehi, the Philistines came toward him shouting. The Spirit of the Lord came upon him in power. The ropes on his arms became like charred flax, and the bindings dropped from his hands. Finding a fresh jawbone of a donkey, he grabbed it and struck down 1,000 men. During this period, the tribes often acted independently and sometimes even in conflict with one another. A tragic example is the civil war against the tribe of Benjamin, as described in Judges 20. The conflict began due to a horrific crime in Gibeah, a city of Benjamin. Judges 20:46-48 recounts the devastating outcome. On that day, 25,000 Benjamites armed for battle fell. But 600 men turned and fled to the desert, to the rock of Rimmon, where they stayed for 4 months. The men of Israel went back to Benjamin and put all the towns to the sword, including the animals and everything they found. They also set fire to all the towns they came across. The era of the judges also saw the rise of internal threats to Israel's faith. The story of Micah and his house of idols, narrated in Judges 17:18, illustrates how idolatry infiltrated the tribes. This episode culminated with the tribe of Dan establishing its own center of idol worship. Judges 18:30-31 states, "There the Danites set up for themselves the idol, and Jonathan son of Gershom, the son of Moses, and his sons were priests for the tribe of Dan, until the day of the captivity of the land. They continued to use the idol Micah had made, all the time the house of God was in Shiloh." The book of Judges ends on a somber note, summarizing the spiritual and moral state of Israel during this period. Judges 21:25 says, "In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as they saw fit." This period of disunity and instability set the stage for the next phase of Israel's history, the transition to monarchy. The people, weary of the cycle of oppression and deliverance, would soon begin to cry out for a king to unite them and lead them against their enemies. The period of the judges was coming to an end, and Israel longed for more stable leadership. Samuel, the last of the judges, was also a prophet and priest. He led the people, but his sons did not follow his righteous ways. This situation led the elders of Israel to make a decision that would change the course of the nation. In 1 Samuel 8, 4-5 we read, "So all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. They said to him, 'You are old, and your sons do not follow your ways. Now appoint a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have.'" This request displeased Samuel, who saw it as a rejection not only of his leadership, but of the theocracy that God had established. Samuel sought divine guidance, and the Lord's response revealed his perspective on the matter. In 1 Samuel 8, 7-9, God says, "Listen to all that the people are saying to you. It is not you they have rejected, but they have rejected me as their king. As they have done from the day I brought them up out of Egypt until this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so they are doing to you. Now listen to them, but warn them solemnly, and let them know what the king who will reign over them will claim as his rights." Despite Samuel's warnings about the dangers of having a human king, the people insisted. God then directed Samuel to anoint Saul from the tribe of Benjamin as the first king of Israel. Saul's selection seemed ideal in the eyes of the people. In 1 Samuel 9:2, he is described as young and handsome. No one in Israel was more handsome than he. He was a head taller than anyone else. Saul's anointing as king was a significant event, marking the beginning of a new era for Israel. 1 Samuel 10:1 states, "Then Samuel took a flask of oil and poured it on Saul's head and kissed him, saying, 'Has not the Lord anointed you leader over his inheritance?'" This anointing was followed by prophetic signs that confirmed the divine choice. Initially, Saul led with humility and effectiveness. His first great victory came against the Ammonites, uniting the tribes under his leadership. 1 Samuel 11:15 describes the public acclaim of Saul. "So all the people went to Gilgal and made Saul king in the presence of the Lord. There they sacrificed fellowship offerings to the Lord, and Saul and all the Israelites held a great celebration." However, Saul's reign soon began to show flaws. His disobedience on two crucial occasions led to his rejection by God as king. The first occurred when Saul offered sacrifices instead of waiting for Samuel, as commanded. The second happened when he spared the Amalekite king and the best of the spoils, contrary to God's order of total destruction. After the second act of disobedience, Samuel declared to Saul in 1 Samuel 15:23, "For rebellion is like the sin of divination, and arrogance like the evil of idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has rejected you as king." It was in this context that God chose a new king for Israel, David, from the tribe of Judah. Samuel was sent secretly to Bethlehem to anoint the young shepherd. 1 Samuel 16:13 records this crucial moment. So Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the presence of his brothers, and from that day on the Spirit of the Lord came powerfully upon David. The contrast between Saul and David soon became evident. While Saul was tormented by an evil spirit, David gained favor with both God and the people. His victory over the giant Goliath, narrated in 1 Samuel 17, solidified his reputation as a warrior and leader. David's rise, however, was not smooth. Saul, consumed by jealousy, pursued David for years, forcing him to live as a fugitive. During this time, David gathered loyal followers from various tribes, inadvertently preparing for his future role as king. After Saul's death in battle against the Philistines, David was anointed king over Judah in Hebron. 2 Samuel 2, 4 records. The men of Judah came to Hebron, and there they anointed David king over the tribe of Judah. However, the complete unification of the kingdom would still take years. Ishbosheth, Saul's son, was proclaimed king over the northern tribes by Abner, Saul's army commander. This led to a civil war that lasted for years. 2 Samuel 3, 1 summarizes, "The war between the house of Saul and the house of David lasted a long time. David grew stronger and stronger, while the house of Saul grew weaker and weaker." Finally, after the assassination of Ishbosheth, all the tribes of Israel came to David, acknowledging him as their king. 2 Samuel 5, 1, 3 narrates this historic moment. All the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, "We are your own flesh and blood. In the past, while Saul was king over us, you were the one who led Israel on their military campaigns. And the Lord said to you, 'You will shepherd my people Israel, and you will become their ruler.'" When all the elders of Israel had come to King David at Hebron, he made a covenant with them at Hebron before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel. The unification of the 12 tribes under David's reign marked the beginning of a new era for Israel. The kingdom was about to enter its period of greatest glory and expansion, fulfilling the promises made by God centuries earlier. With David on the throne, Israel entered an era of unprecedented expansion and prosperity. His first significant act was to conquer Jerusalem, which would become the capital of the United Kingdom. 2 Samuel 5, 7 records, "Nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion, which is the city of David." David brought the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem, centralizing worship of God in the new capital. This act symbolized the unity of the 12 tribes under a unique political and spiritual leadership. 2 Samuel 6:15 describes the scene. "So David and all the house of Israel brought up the Ark of the Lord, with shouting and with the sound of the trumpet." David's reign was marked by military victories that expanded the borders of Israel. 2 Samuel 8:15 summarizes his government. "David reigned over all Israel, administering justice and righteousness to all his people." Despite his successes, David also faced personal and family challenges, including the rebellion of his son Absalom. However, he maintained his faith in God and his commitment to the covenant. At the end of his reign, David prepared his son Solomon to succeed him. 1 Chronicles 28, 9-10 records his counsel. "And you, Solomon my son, know the God of your father, and serve him with a loyal heart and with a willing mind. For the Lord searches all hearts and understands all the intent of the thoughts. If you seek him, he will be found by you, but if you forsake him, he will cast you off forever. Consider now, for the Lord has chosen you to build a house for the sanctuary. Be strong and do it." Solomon's reign marked the height of the United Kingdom. His wisdom and wealth became legendary. 1 Kings 4:29. 30 says, "And God gave Solomon wisdom, an exceedingly great understanding, and largeness of heart like the sand on the seashore. Thus Solomon's wisdom exceeded the wisdom of all the men of the East, and all the wisdom of Egypt." Solomon's most ambitious project was the construction of the temple in Jerusalem. 1 Kings 6, 1 marks the beginning of this undertaking. It came to pass in the 480th year, after the children of Israel had come out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, which is the second month, that he began to build the house of the Lord. The dedication of the temple was a moment of great national celebration. 1 Kings 8, 65 reports, "So Solomon and all the congregation of Israel, who had assembled with him, were with him before the ark, sacrificing sheep and oxen that could not be counted or numbered for multitude. Solomon's fame attracted visitors from distant lands, such as the Queen of Sheba. 1 Kings 10:7 records her words of admiration. "However, I did not believe the words until I came and saw with my own eyes, and indeed the half was not told me. Your wisdom and prosperity exceed the fame of which I heard." However, the glory of Solomon's kingdom hid seeds of decline. His many political alliances, sealed by marriages to foreign princesses, introduced idolatry into Israel. 1 Kings 11:4 reveals, "For it was so, when Solomon was old, that his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not loyal to the Lord his God, as was the heart of his father David." This unfaithfulness led to serious consequences. God declared that he would divide the kingdom after Solomon's death. 1 Kings 11:11, 13 records. "Therefore the Lord said to Solomon, because you have done this and have not kept my covenant and my statutes, which I have commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom away from you and give it to your servant. Nevertheless, I will not do it in your days, for the sake of your father David. I will tear it out of the hand of your son. However, I will not tear away the whole kingdom. I will give one tribe to your son for the sake of my servant David, and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen." The tensions between the tribes, which had been suppressed during David's reign and the early part of Solomon's reign, began to resurface. The tribe of Ephraim in particular resented the dominance of the tribe of Judah. The decline became evident in the heavy taxes and forced labor that Solomon imposed to maintain his luxurious lifestyle and his building projects. 1 Kings 12:4 reveals the people's discontent. "Your father made our yoke heavy. Now therefore lighten the burdensome service of your father and his heavy yoke which he put on us, and we will serve you." Thus, by the end of Solomon's reign, the United Kingdom was on the verge of division. The 12 tribes of Israel, which had experienced a period of unprecedented glory, were on the brink of a schism that would forever change the course of their history. With Solomon's death, the latent tensions between the tribes came to the forefront. His son Rehoboam went to Shechem to be proclaimed king, but the people, led by Jeroboam, presented their demands. 1 Kings 12:3, 4 states, "So they sent and called him, and Jeroboam and all the congregation of Israel came and spoke to Rehoboam, saying, your father made our yoke heavy. Now therefore lighten the burdensome service of your father and his heavy yoke which he put on us, and we will serve you." Rehoboam's harsh response precipitated the division of the kingdom. 1 Kings 12:16 describes the reaction of the northern tribes. "Now when all Israel saw that the king did not listen to them, the people answered the king, saying, what share have we in David? We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. To your tents, O Israel. Now see to your own house, O David." So Israel departed to their tents. Thus the kingdom was divided. 10 northern tribes formed the kingdom of Israel, with its capital in Samaria, while Judah and Benjamin remained loyal to the house of David, forming the kingdom of Judah, with its capital in Jerusalem. Jeroboam, fearing that the people would return their loyalty to Jerusalem during the religious festivals, established alternative worship centers in Dan and Bethel. 1 Kings 12:28, 29 recounts his fateful decision. "Therefore the king asked advice, made 2 calves of gold, and said to the people, it is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Here are your gods, O Israel, which brought you up from the land of Egypt." And he set up one in Bethel, and the other he put in Dan. This decision established a pattern of idolatry in the northern kingdom that would persist throughout its history. The subsequent kings of Israel are often described as following the sins of Jeroboam. While this was happening, the kingdom of Judah experienced periods of faithfulness and apostasy. Some kings, such as Asa, Jehoshaphat, and Hezekiah, promoted religious reforms and sought to restore the worship of Yahweh. 2 Chronicles 29:2, 3 describes Hezekiah's actions. He did what the Lord approved, just as his ancestor David had done. In the first month of the first year of his reign, he opened the doors of the temple of the Lord and repaired them. The northern kingdom faced constant political instability, with various dynasties being overthrown by coups. In contrast, the southern kingdom maintained the Davidic lineage on the throne, fulfilling God's promise to David. Both kingdoms faced external threats. The northern kingdom in particular suffered from invasions by Syria and Assyria. Finally, in 722 BC, Samaria fell to the Assyrians. 2 Kings 17. 6 records this tragic event. In the 9th year of Hoshea's reign, the king of Assyria captured Samaria and deported the Israelites to Assyria. He settled them in Hala, in Gozan, along the Habor River, and in the cities of the Medes. The fall of Samaria marked the end of the northern kingdom and resulted in the exile of the 10 tribes. 2 Kings 17:18 summarizes, "So the Lord was very angry with Israel and removed them from his presence. Only the tribe of Judah was spared." The exact fate of the exiled 10 tribes is a subject of much debate and speculation. While some families may have escaped south and integrated into Judah, most were assimilated by the nations to which they were exiled, losing their distinct identity as Israelites. The kingdom of Judah survived for over a century after the fall of Israel, but it also faced increasing challenges. Despite the reforms of kings like Hezekiah and Josiah, idolatry and social injustice persisted. Finally, in 586 BC, Jerusalem fell to the Babylonians. 2 Kings 25, 8:11 narrates this devastating event. On the 7th day of the 5th month in the 19th year of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, Nebuzaradan, commander of the imperial guard, a servant of the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem. He set fire to the temple of the Lord, the royal palace, and all the houses of Jerusalem. Every important building he burned down. The whole Babylonian army, under the commander of the guard, broke down the walls around Jerusalem. Nebuzaradan, the commander of the guard, carried into exile the people who remained in the city, along with the rest of the populace and those who had surrendered to the king of Babylon. This event, known as the Babylonian exile, marked the end of the kingdom of Judah. However, unlike the northern tribes, the exiles from Judah maintained their identity and religious traditions during captivity. 70 years later, under the decree of Cyrus, king of Persia, a remnant of Judah returned to their land. Ezra 1:2. Three records this historic decree. This is what Cyrus, king of Persia, says: "The Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and has appointed me to build a temple for him at Jerusalem in Judah. Any of his people among you may go up to Jerusalem in Judah and build the temple of the Lord, the God of Israel, the God who is in Jerusalem." This return marked the beginning of the Second Temple period, where the descendants of Judah, Benjamin and Levi, along with some remnants of the other tribes, re-established the Jewish community in the land of Israel. The history of the 12 tribes of Israel is an epic narrative of faith, failure, and redemption. From their origins as a patriarchal family to their evolution as a powerful nation, and through their division and exile, the tribes of Israel played a central role in biblical history and the formation of both Jewish and later Christian faith. Each tribe contributed uniquely to this story. Judah emerged as the leading tribe, providing the royal lineage and eventually the promised Messiah. Levi maintained its priestly role, preserving religious traditions even in exile. Ephraim and Manasseh, the tribes of Joseph, led the northern kingdom, fulfilling Jacob's blessing. Benjamin, the smallest of the tribes, remained faithful to the house of David and survived the Babylonian exile. Reuben, Simeon, and Gad, established east of the Jordan, were the first to face foreign invasions. Zebulun and Issachar, located in the fertile Jezreel Valley, played important roles in the economy of the northern kingdom. Dan and Naphtali, in the far north, were crucial in defending against Syrian invasions. Asher, on the Mediterranean coast, excelled in maritime trade. Even after the exile and the loss of distinct tribal identity, the concept of the 12 tribes remained central in Jewish consciousness. In the New Testament, the Apostle James addresses the 12 tribes scattered among the nations, James 1:1, and the book of Revelation describes 144,000 sealed, 12,000 from each tribe, Revelation 7:4, 8. The history of the 12 tribes of Israel is ultimately a story of promise and fulfillment. The promise made to Abraham of a great nation was fulfilled, though in ways that the patriarchs could hardly have imagined. Through triumphs and tragedies, the tribes of Israel demonstrated God's faithfulness to his promises and the ongoing call to the people's faithfulness. This narrative continues to shape the identity and faith of millions of people around the world. It reminds us that, just like the tribes of Israel, we are part of a larger story, a story of redemption that transcends nations and generations. As we reflect on this epic journey, we are challenged to consider our own role in God's ongoing story. Like the tribes of Israel, we are called to live in faithfulness, to preserve our spiritual heritage, and to be a light to the nations. The history of the 12 tribes teaches us that despite our failures, God's grace endures and His promises last through the ages.